Hello, everyone. My name is Aaron Bauer, one of the PGY4 neurology residents here at Yale. Welcome back to the Neurology Exam Prep Podcast. Today, I'm going to be joined by Dr. Moeller to discuss a little bit about mitochondrial diseases. Good afternoon, Dr. Moeller.
Oh, hey, Aaron. How you doing? It's great to be back in the saddle again, talking about something that either of us doesn't have any specific expertise on. But maybe, I don't know, well, let's just say that that could be a benefit because we can explain this at the level of a neurologist or somebody that needs to study this and maybe not the highest level of expertise. So listener, beware about that, but hopefully this will be helpful. And Aaron, you've shared your outline with me and you have so many references and we'll list those in the show notes. And I think that would be really nice to share what you've learned with our listeners in a way that's concise and helpful and clinically useful and useful in preparing for exams.
No, agreed. I mean, I feel like it's definitely a topic that can have an exceeding amount of depth. So I tried to do my best to kind of narrow things down as relevant as we can be, particularly in terms of, you know, being a neurologist.
All right. So do you want to get started?
Sure. So I think where I wanted to start originally with this is just to identify maybe a few themes just regarding mitochondrial disease, because there are some things that are kind of kept constant, if you will, across many of these disorders, particularly regarding the mutations, their inheritance, some of the demographics, and really these common symptoms, perhaps, just given the ultimate shared pathology of these diseases, being these kind of metabolic requirements and demands that really are stressed and the organ systems that are going to be most commonly involved. Does that sound like a reasonable place to start, at least, before we get into some specific diseases?
Yeah, I think that's good. And I think it will help remind our listeners when they should be considering the possibility of a mitochondrial disease. As you talk about mutations, inheritance, to think about how they could be diagnosed and what types of patterns we might see in the disease pathology and disease processes. And these can have a number of different faces. But as you said, there are common themes. And understanding a little bit about the genetics and pathophysiology, I think, can help with that. So I think that's a great place to start.
Sounds good. So with that in mind, in terms of the mutation and the inheritance, I think most of our listeners would be aware of mitochondrial mutations being inherited in what we describe as the maternal pattern of inheritance, so through the maternal mitochondrial DNA. But it is definitely worth knowing that some of these diseases actually are encoded on the nuclear genome as well. So kind of outside of the mitochondrial mutations and that maternal pattern of inheritance that our listeners may be more commonly aware of, there are nuclear genomic mutations as well. And these are going to follow that more traditional Mendelian inheritance pattern that we think of with, you know, other inheritable diseases.
Yeah, and just looking at the number of genes involved, you know, in one of the sources that you shared with me, actually, it looks like at least as many, if not more, genes are actually located in nuclear DNA than in mitochondrial DNA. But of course, in disease processes, the mitochondrial DNA mutations are often the ones that are affected.
Agreed. And will also be one thing that most people will probably see on the test, and that will be a clue of a mitochondrial disease being hinted at, is kind of this maternal pattern of inheritance. But more broadly, good to keep in mind that some of these will be Mendelian as well. Now, with that said, they are relatively rare conditions. The prevalence in the US and Canada is about 1 in 4,000, globally, a little even less, 1 in 5,000. And the symptoms overall, I feel obligated that I have to say that the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell during this lecture at least once. So we can always think about these as kind of having clinical manifestations from organs with really high metabolic requirements and demands. And really, this kind of shared group of organs are going to be the ones that are most commonly involved. So as neurologists, obviously, the first thing I will mention will be the brain. Then I will go a little further and even say muscles. And then we'll have to think about the heart, the retina, the cochlea. All of these structures are the ones that are generally going to be most commonly affected in mitochondrial disease.
Yeah, it's always a clue, right? Visual symptoms, hearing problems, some sort of neurocognitive syndrome, muscle weakness, some combination of those is often very common and a clue. And you know, this podcast exists for exam preparation, as the name implies. And when you see those things clustering together in something that's slowly progressive or episodic, then you really start to think about the possibility of mitochondrial disease. And yes, I suppose we should apologize in even alluding to the electron transport chain and the Krebs cycle, but it turns out that's really important. And I guess there's a reason why that's at the core of medical physiology courses in the first year of most medical schools. So shout out to all our medical student listeners who may be just recovering from their physiology courses.
Yeah, luckily, after step one, I guess it gets a little bit more in the background, but as you're saying, it's always there. In terms of the onset of these diseases and the phenotype of these diseases, it's going to be exceptionally variable. Most of the cases that will be seen, particularly cases that are severe, will be in the more pediatric realm or even neonatal, but they can be present all the way up through adulthood in terms of, you know, first being presented to, you know, medical care. And consequently, the phenotype then will be very severe to very mild disease. And I think it's interesting to note that the reason for this is the way in which mitochondrial inheritance kind of influences that presentation. So there are some interesting things regarding how mitochondrial DNA and how mitochondrial function is separated in the body. So there's mitochondrial segregation. So ultimately, these mitochondria have a random share of kind of that mutated and non-mutated DNA between all of its progeny as it goes through. And they can be segregated into different populations of cells. And obviously, depending on where they're clustering, you can have more or less phenotypic expression. You can also have the concept of heteroplasmy play a part of this. And that's essentially kind of along the same line of that you have a coexistence of two populations of mitochondrial DNA, both normal and mutated, that will change essentially the stress with which the mitochondria can function and the tissue can actually compensate. And that goes along with the threshold effect as well, where ultimately you need a specific amount of mutated mitochondrial DNA to be present before you actually have pathologic impairment of the oxidative metabolism. And each type of cell has a different threshold based on their kind of metabolic demands. So all of these things together will ultimately lead to those phenotypic and kind of onsets and variability.
And it's what you're talking about here, Aaron, would be those that are related to mutations of mitochondrial DNA, right?
So specifically, yes.
So disorders that are related to mutations of mitochondrial DNA, you know, you inherit about, you know, half of your mother's mitochondria, right? Or so, depending on the cell and so on. And that's the segregation issue. Of course, there are mitochondrial disorders, as you said, that are related to Mendelian inheritance, and this would not apply in that context. So this is specifically for disorders of mitochondrial DNA. And as we go through the specific disorders, we'll talk about which ones are related to mutations of the mitochondrial DNA and which might have other inheritance patterns.
Exactly. Thank you for being clear on that point. We're not going to spend a ton of time talking about treatment considerations, just given that a lot of this is still experimental or there are trials going on for specific mutations. But largely, it's going to be supportive for all of these. There's some consideration of supplementation, like with coenzyme Q10, B vitamins, carnitine. So one of the other few things that we'll mention is maybe some drugs that should be avoided. And if there are any specifically, I'll make a mention. But really anything that has toxic mitochondrial effects, particularly like alcohol, cigarettes, or certain antibiotics like the aminoglycosides, like they may worsen things a little bit more acutely. But largely speaking, we're going to step away from some of the treatment when we get into the specifics. Do you have anything else more generally to add about these diseases, Dr. Mueller?
No, I mean, I think what I would say is, and we'll talk about this, when we identify a patient with a mitochondrial disorder, we're often seeking expert opinion from quaternary care centers because there, as you said, are ongoing clinical trials. And if there's anything that can help, ideally, we would want experts who really collect patients, who see them together, who are able to get them into trials for very rare diseases, to help. So one thing I would say is that we typically are referring patients with suspected or confirmed mitochondrial disorders to specific sub-specialists for those more advanced treatments or experimental treatments. And hopefully there will be a time in the future when some of these disorders have better and more reliable treatments for them.
Agreed. We definitely need to be aware of all of these things, though, to make sure we get patients where they're best served and ultimately advance what we do know. So with the general introduction kind of done, at least with some common themes, we're going to end up talking about 6 to 7, maybe specific diseases. All of them are relatively quick because I feel like most of the information, at least for an exam reason and for, you know, out and being clinically minded, will be being able to identify the syndrome and when to be concerned about it. I'm not going to spend too much time on the specific mutations as most of them have a few. And to be honest, they can be easily looked up, but I will mention them in brief. So the first disease that we're going to talk about, and probably the one that's most familiar with a lot of our listeners, is going to be MELOS, or mitochondrial myopathy, encephalopathy, lactic acidosis, and stroke-like episodes. So the most common mutation for this one is going to be a mitochondrial mutation in a tRNA, particularly tRNA-L, and there's a point mutation associated with most cases of MELOS. The symptoms, as we've alluded to with those kind of big boxes in the beginning, but one of the key features is going to be these stroke-like episodes, as in its name. These can be associated with seizures, and usually these patients will have migraineous-like headaches. Additionally, they may have some ataxia and the other things I've mentioned in the beginning. So there could be the cognitive impairment, hearing loss, cardiomyopathies, and short stature. Diagnostically, a lot of these patients, particularly on the MRI brain, when they're having a stroke-like episode, you'll see T2 flare hyperintensities. The DWI can be hyperintense. The ADC is usually variable, and there can be some patchy contrast enhancement. The key thing with these is usually the flare hyperintensities are going to be inconsistent with the vascular territory. So they're not going to be consistent with a PCA, MCA, and ACA territory. They're going to be very inconsistent. They're going to cross those borders. Most commonly, you see them in the posterior regions of the brain, so in the parietal occipital area. And the cerebral cortex is usually involved as well and can appear brightened and thickened on the T2-weighted imaging. These lesions will develop over time. They can kind of migrate to adjacent sites over weeks to months. And the expectation is they spontaneously reverse. And that will be both reversal of their focal neurologic symptoms related to that lesion and the lesions themselves radiographically. In terms of other testing that's done, when you look at their serum and CSF, like some of the other mitochondrial diseases, you will expect to see things like an elevated lactate, elevated pyruvate, as you have those deficits in the oxidative phosphorylation. And in terms of treatment, there aren't, as I said, specific treatments for this. The only thing worth noting that's maybe a little bit specific for MELAS would be in some patients, there's been trials of L-arginine to try and decrease these attack frequencies and decrease the symptoms during those acute attacks of these stroke-like episodes. Do you have any other comments for at least MELAS, Dr. Moeller?
No, I think that the key features one would see on an exam would be somebody in early middle age, maybe a little younger, may or may not have a family history, has a history of migraines, and has recurrent episodes of transient focal neurological dysfunction that looks like stroke. And I think that's the clue. And often on MRI, then what you would see are these multifocal lesions, again, initially sort of patchy and then becoming confluent, as you said, and that it's a really a subacute or chronic process. And so, you know, that's going to be the clue. The age is going to be sort of, like I said, adulthood, early middle age, slowly progressive, maybe a gradually progressing neurodegenerative process, but with these superimposed stroke-like symptoms, and then often migraine or even migraine with aura. So those are the clues that you might see. And that may be the clue to key you into this being a point mutation of one of the mitochondrial genes that causes this MELAS syndrome.
Fantastic. I think the next one that we were going to talk about was going to be Lee syndrome, which is also known as subacute necrotizing encephalomyelopathy. So this syndrome is going to be seen maybe in some of our more pediatric presentations. So in that younger age group, typically, the clinical onset is going to be even within the first 2 years of life, from what I could see. The mutation for this one is much harder, so it's a little bit more variable. But ultimately, there's an early failure in how the mitochondria is going through its bioenergetic pathways. This can be mitochondrial, it can be nuclear, or it can even be related to some deficiencies in specific respiratory chain enzymes. So for Lee syndrome, this subacute necrotizing encephalomyelopathy, the mutation may not be as straightforward as some of the other diseases we've talked about, even like MELAS, where the most common one is just this point mutation in the mitochondrial DNA. Similarly, the symptoms you'll see, particularly if it's in a child who's young, you're going to have psychomotor delay and regressions. They'll generally be a little hypotonic. They can present with seizures and also a generalized weakness or ataxia. There does seem to be a bit of a clinical spectrum with mitochondrial DNA-related cases. And there's other mitochondrial diseases that have a little bit more specific names, like maternally inherited Lee syndrome or MILS. That's a very severe early onset presentation of the disease. And then something called NARC, which is neuropathy, ataxia, retinitis pigmentosa, which is a more benign late onset form of the disease. So there is a bit of a spectrum within that mitochondrial disease related cases. Diagnostically, in the classic Lee syndrome, what you'll see on the brain and spinal cord is you'd imagine with an encephalomyelopathy, you'll have these T2 hyperintense lesions. There's a predilection to the rostral spinal cord, and that can extend all the way up through the brainstem and include the cerebellum, leading to some of the ataxia that can be seen in these patients. In the diencephalon, usually there's a pretty high involvement of the basal ganglia, and that can actually lead to necrosing signs on like SWI as well. It seems on like pathologic evaluation of these, it's actually kind of reflective of an underlying demyelination, and then ultimately transitioning to necrosis with spongiosis. As with MELAS, you will have an elevated lactate in both your serum and CSF, and there really isn't any additional big treatment options that I could really see for this one outside of supportive care with like really bad lactic acidosis giving bicarb, but that's a much more general recommendation.
Yeah, and you know, neither of us are child neurologists, but this is on the differential diagnosis for an early onset, right? Early childhood onset, progressively worsening syndrome with the features that you said, you know, delay or regression, seizures, weakness, ataxia. It's this sort of whole neuroaxis type of problem that's slowly progressive. And the imaging features and the findings really strongly include the spinal cord. And as you said, the diencephalon, I think those are some of the clues that might point you to this syndrome. So the age of onset is a really huge clue and is distinctive from some of the other syndromes that we're talking about today. This occurs much earlier and has a much greater variability in terms of his inheritance, but does produce a much more severe dysfunction of the mitochondrial process, the oxidative process.
Oh, definitely one of the more quickly progressive ones, and particularly devastating when it's a more severe form. The next two that we're going to talk about may be a little bit blurring the line with some ophthalmology as well. So the first one that we're going to talk about is going to be CPEO, or chronic progressive external ophthalmoplegia. And given its relationship and kind of spectrum with one other mitochondrial disease, I decided that we maybe can lump these two together. So along with CPEO, we'll talk about Kearns-Sayre syndrome as well. So there seems to be a common mutation here. For CPEO, it's a lot more variable. They found mitochondrial mutations, both deletions, point mutations, and also some POLG mutations as well, which may come up for one of our last syndromes. And then with Kearns-Sayre syndrome, there's specifically a mitochondrial deletion involving a very large amount of mitochondrial DNA, almost up to 5,000 base pairs, and that's the most common one by far. And that's in about a third of cases. This one's both CPEO and Kearns-Sayre overall, though, have more variability in their genetics, but generally are going to follow that more classic mitochondrial inheritance pattern. The symptoms, and we'll start with maybe CPEO, is a mitochondrial myopathy affecting the extraocular movements and muscles of the eye. So it's going to be your extraocular muscles, and it's going to be the levator of your eyelid as well. So these patients will develop a chronic, progressive, notably painless, kind of pupil-sparing weakness of the muscles of the eye and the eyelid. In terms of Kearns-Sayre syndrome, this is going to be essentially the same ocular findings, but a lot of extra stuff. It's just essentially a much more severe presentation with more systemic involvement. So particularly, these patients are going to have a more generalized weakness. They'll have bulbar involvement, facial involvement, even down into their neck and pharynx. They'll have the cardiac complications with heart blocks, ataxia, short stature, deafness, more of those other classically associated mitochondrial disease involvement. The age is also going to be a little bit younger for Kearns-Sayre compared to CPEO. So in Kearns-Sayre, we're usually thinking of people less than 20. And CPEO can be present in much more, even just adults in general. In terms of some of the diagnostic features, one thing that's interesting about these two diseases is sometimes the lumbar puncture will have an elevated protein, and that can actually be part of the diagnosis, particularly for Kearns-Sayre. And on the MRI, usually CPEO will not have as many systemic, you know, have much involvement, but with Kearns-Sayre, which is the more systemically and severe, you'll have flare hyperintensities both in the brainstem, some of the deep brain structures like the globus pallidus, thalamus, and even the white matter of the cerebrum and cerebellum. And in the most severe cases can actually look like a leukoencephalopathy. The treatment for this for CPEO is actually going to be guided a lot by ophthalmology. They get strabismus surgery, they can have prisms, they can even get frontalis slings to hold up their ptosis. And then in obviously Kearns-Sayre, you have to be a little bit more involved with looking for cardiac conduction issues. And some people will require a little bit of supplementation. There's been a role of maybe folate in some of these patients. But I think these two disease processes I always kind of have lumped in my head and just think of Kearns-Sayre as the more systemically involved of the two.
Yeah, I remember studying these disorders and in my own mind making the distinction that Kearns-Sayre is in my mind almost like CPEO plus, right? CPEO is primarily mitochondrial myopathy of the eye muscles, right? Of the muscles of eye movement and the muscles of eyelid elevation. And it could have other features, but that's primarily the feature. And Kern's stare is much more severe. And because it's much more severe, it makes sense to me that it might have an earlier onset, right? All of these disorders of mitochondrial function are going to catch up with you eventually. And the more severe the mutation or the more critical that function, the earlier it's going to catch up with you, right? We talked about Lee syndrome, for example, being a very early onset, progressive, often fatal. And CPEO is usually not. And Kern's stare is somewhere in the middle. And I, you know, without having a lot of expertise about the mitochondrial function, I sort of think in my mind, the more severe disorders, the more significant and critical the mutation, the earlier onset you're going to see it, and the more widespread the dysfunction, both within the nervous system and without the nervous system like this. But the crossover is both of these do involve abnormalities of the eye muscles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for anyone lucky enough to have a neuro-ophthalmology program within their training, it's definitely interesting to see. I know I've seen one person with CPEO specifically, and it was definitely quite striking because they had been pretty far along in their course. So the next mitochondrial disease that we're going to talk about, kind of sticking along with the eye theme for a minute, is going to be Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy. There seems to be about 3 primary mutations for this one. That accounts for the majority of the cases, about 95% of them. The most common is going to be a point mutation. These are going to be all mitochondrial specifically. So the mitochondrial point mutation that's most common is a switch for a G to an A. There's many a numberings that go along with these, but the listener can look at those in the show notes if they want. It used to actually be thought to be exclusively mitochondrial, in fact, but there are maybe some rare cases where this has been challenged. But I would say the rule more so is that this is a mitochondrially inherited disorder. In terms of the symptoms, these patients generally present from the age of like 15 to 35, so early adulthood to late adolescence. They'll come in with a progressive, painless central visual loss. And usually one thing that's pretty profound about them is there's very early and severe color loss associated with that. The tempo can vary. Some patients can have a very acute process, or it's something that progresses over months. So it can vary in terms of how quickly it comes on. But ultimately, over time, they'll progress to a very dense visual loss. And it's not uncommon for them to present originally with monocular symptoms and then have the second eye become involved even weeks or months later. Some interesting features that may be helpful here and probably would come up just given that most of these patients first present to ophthalmology is a lot of these patients will undergo testing with an OCT, so optical coherence tomography. Acutely, they can actually see things like optic hyperemia, pseudoedema. They can have these telangiectatic vessels. And on visual evoked potentials that you'd imagined with all of this dysfunction in the nerve, the optic nerve, they end up having prolonged latencies and the waveforms end up looking notably abnormal. There are some treatment considerations, I think, you know, just maybe to tease the listeners about some things down the line, you know, there are specific gene therapies for these, especially as most of them are, you know, common point mutations. And there's several studies out there looking at viral vectors like the rescue trial, reverse trial, or flex studies. So there are a lot of active studies and enrollment going on for Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy, which I think is one that invariably will come up for a lot of neurologists over time, because it is going to be one of the more common mitochondrial diseases out there.
Yeah, the thing I would add here, and I think we had a podcast on optic neuropathies maybe a few months ago, and we talked about later onset optic neuropathies, so something that might happen after childhood, and Leber hereditary optic neuropathy would be on that list. And this sequential painless visual loss is one of the clues, right? This you completely lose vision in one eye gradually over a period of weeks or months. And then you might not see loss of vision in the other eye until later, that sequential point. That's a real clue that this might be the syndrome you're dealing with, especially in the absence of any inflammatory process or nutritional deficiency or any of the other things that we talk about when we talk about optic neuropathy. So LHON should be on the list of a monocular ocular neuropathy on a unilateral optic neuropathy, because it can often present unilaterally, as you said, but usually eventually the second eye will catch up, and that can sometimes be where the other shoe drops and you make the diagnosis.
No, and this is the only diagnosis I've seen personally on this list, and they came in acutely after starting to binge drink. So a bit of a mitochondrial stressor on top of a predisposition led to a tipping off of it in the beginning. And only later was it kind of found out that the underlying cause was LHON.
Yeah, it's a good point, right? Some of these mitochondrial disorders can get worse in the context of an acute physiologic stress. You mentioned substances, whether it be drugs or alcohol, infections, especially severe infections. And sometimes that clouds the picture, right? We're distracted by these other things and then it shows up later. So mitochondrial diseases are really tricky to diagnose. And I haven't met too many patients with mitochondrial diseases where we made the diagnosis right away on the first presentation. Usually this is something where you're following someone, you can't explain it, and you eventually make the diagnosis once the features sort of coalesce. And I think just having it on your list of possibilities early keeps an open mind and opens up these patients to the opportunity for some of the treatments we discussed and also exposure to treatment trials. And the last thing I'll say about this is that just on a clinical skills sort of perspective, it's one of the reasons when we haven't totally figured out what's wrong with someone, which is not unusual in neurology, we keep following them because eventually, in many cases, the information starts to come together and all of a sudden the diagnosis becomes more clear.
It's one of the things that I love most and why I'm looking forward to heading to the outpatient side a little bit more regularly. So the next one, I think maybe will be the most up your alley, Dr. Muller. So the next one will be MRF, which is myoclonic epilepsy with ragged red fibers. So this one does have a pretty common mutation. This one specifically will be most of the time, 80% of cases, mitochondrial will be an A to G kind of mutation. Symptoms will generally occur in childhood. And the core symptom for these patients is going to be a progressive myoclonic epilepsy, but they can have some variable other seizure types involved, be it bilateral tonic-clonic, atonic, and absence. And then they'll also have those other additional mitochondrial signs that we've laid out before, like the myopathy, ataxia, cardiac problems. In terms of diagnosis, there are on EEG, from what I could see, pretty slow background. They'll have generalized epileptiform discharges. On the muscle biopsy, you will see these ragged red fibers that can be pretty classic with mitochondrial disease. So these ragged red fibers themselves is actually the accumulation of abnormal mitochondria beneath the plasma membrane. And that's on the Gomori trichrome stain, which I could very well and have seen on some test prep questions in the past. It's a very pretty stain, all things considered. I'd recommend our listeners to take a peek at it.
Yeah, it's fairly classic. It was a common theme in my residency. I think there's less and less pathology on high stakes examinations as the world has moved forward and we have other diagnostic techniques to complement pathological specimens for better or worse. And pathology was a big part of my training. And the Gomori trichrome stain, as the name implies, has three colors or three types of stains with it. On muscle fibers, it sort of has this, I'm colorblind, but this greenish look, would you say, Aaron? Is it green?
No, I'd agree with that.
And the mitochondria look reddish. And they're basically these clumps of red that are accumulating on the edges of the muscle fibers, right? So they're not in the middle of the muscle fibers. They're sort of clumps of these red fibers around the edges. And our listeners can look this up on any search engine, but they will see these accumulations of this reddish tinge, these reddish fibers on the edges of a green stain. Honestly, the presence of the Gomori trichrome stain, which has this characteristic green color with the muscle fibers, is probably enough to clue you in to this might be a mitochondrial disease. But what you want to look for is that reddish edge around the edges of the muscle fibers. And that's going to be the clue of abnormal mitochondrial accumulation and a mitochondrial disorder. And you can see ragged red fibers with other mitochondrial diseases, but the classic one would be MRF.
Exactly. There are a few other things. I feel like I've always talked about the MRI findings. For MRF, usually what's seen is a pretty predominant cerebral and cerebellar atrophy. And interestingly, some of these patients actually can develop calcifications in their dentate nucleus and the cerebellum, almost kind of reminiscent of Farr syndrome, except without the other involvement. In terms of serum, they also have the elevated lactate. And given the more predominant muscle involvement, there will also be elevated CK. Some of the treatment considerations here, and maybe, I don't know if you'd want to talk about a few things, Dr. Muller, at least in terms of medications probably to avoid in a myoclonic epilepsy. But there has been some use of those supplements, like I said in the beginning, like carnitine, coenzyme Q10.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about the treatment of mitochondrial diseases beyond what you've said. We do know that some sodium channel modulating agents can worsen myoclonus, and in a progressive myoclonic epilepsy syndrome, you might see that. And I would refer our listeners back to our episode on myoclonus, which was probably about a year ago, Aaron, maybe a little longer. We could look it up. And in that episode, we talked about both peripheral, brainstem, spinal, et cetera, myoclonus, and also cortical myoclonus. And then we took a little deviation into the common causes of the progressive myoclonus epilepsy syndromes, the PMEs. And in that list, we briefly touched on MRF, but there, of course, there are other disorders which can cause a similar syndrome. The clues that this might be a mitochondrial disorder when somebody has this progressive myoclonic epilepsy syndrome would be the weakness, right? This myopathy. So basically, weakness of proximal muscles, maybe cardiac arrhythmia if there's involvement of the cardiac muscle and loss of tone, et cetera, in addition to the progressive difficult to treat epilepsy. And sometimes that's a clue that it could be the mitochondrial disorder.
I don't think I had much else to add for MRF. I don't know if you have any other final comments, Dr. Muller.
No, I would slot it in with the progressive myoclonus epilepsy syndromes when you're studying, and then you can also include it in other mitochondrial diseases, but really it helps to be slotted in with the PMEs. And there's a list of disorders that we talk about when we talk about PMEs, which I can point our listeners to that previous episode.
Fantastic. Oh, I think the next one, and I'll be 100% honest, I hadn't heard about this one at all until doing a bit of research for this. And then ultimately it came up a little bit later, I think in the resident and fellow section for neurology. So this is MNGY, or mitochondrial neurogastrointestinal encephalomyopathy. So this one has a common mutation. It's going to be nuclear. So this is actually thymidine phosphorylase gene mutation. It's inherited in an autorecessive fashion. Essentially, the thymidine phosphorylase catabolizes both thymidine and deoxyuridine. And when you have mutations of this gene, ultimately you get accumulation of both thymidine and deoxyuridine, and mitochondrial DNA defects essentially accumulate. And that eventually hits a threshold where the patients begin to have symptoms. Usually those symptoms will begin in childhood to young adulthood. The core symptoms here, from outside of the neurologic symptoms, which we'll talk about, but they'll have predominant GI symptoms. So neurogastrointestinal in the name. So they have a lot of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, early satiety, sometimes even just severe abdominal pain. And the motility issues can be to the point where they actually end up developing bowel perforations and weight loss. That is notable. From a neurologic standpoint, the things that are generally seen, they may develop a peripheral neuropathy, myopathy. They can have eye movement abnormalities that mimic CPEO, and they can develop a more diffuse leukoencephalopathy when it's notably severe, obviously with neuropsychiatric impairment once it gets to that point. From a diagnostic standpoint, the MRI for these patients, as I was alluding to, they can develop these flare white matter hyperintensities. They usually are bilateral and patchy, and then will progress to be confluent and involve the deeper structures and even down into the midbrains and pons with time. In terms of workup that's done by GI, they'll have difficulties with swallowing, they'll have difficulties with gastric emptying, and really alter GI motility in transit. And as similar to others, you'll have the elevated lactate. They additionally will have elevated LFTs, lipase, amylase, and early onset diabetes is a little bit more associated with this one. Interestingly, at least in terms of treatment, you can supplement this in theory. You can give an erythrocyte encapsulated thymidine phosphorylase, so there is enzyme replacement. And there are some that look at hematopoietic stem cell transplants or liver transplantation. But I think this was one that I maybe wasn't familiar with and was figured one which was good to include, particularly if you're thinking mitochondrial and also predominant GI symptoms.
I'll take your word for it. But I think that our listeners are appreciative of you sharing this. I've heard of MNGY. I've certainly never seen a patient with it, but all of this is really important to consider.
I think I only had one left that I thought would be worth discussing, and that would be Alport syndrome. So this is a common mutation of the POLG1 gene, and similarly is going to be nuclear. So it's autosomal recessively inherited. And the gene essentially encodes for a DNA polymerase, and particularly it's the polymerase gamma, and it's the key protein involved in mitochondrial DNA replication. So consequently, these patients develop a severe depletion of the mitochondrial DNA. Now, there are POLG mutations that are generally going to be the most frequent cause of mitochondrial epilepsy. from what I could see in epidemiological work. So in terms of mitochondrial epilepsy, at all ages, the Polk gene mutations will be the most frequent cause. The symptoms generally are going to occur in infancy, so even at the end of the first year of life, so very early. The core symptoms are a triad. Usually they think of neurodevelopmental regression, intractable seizures, and liver failure. It's not uncommon for these patients to present with new onset status or even something like epilepsia partialis continua or EPC. So as we may have discussed with Lee syndrome in the past as well, they'll have other things alongside of that. So the hypotonia, the developmental delay, ataxia, hearing loss. So in this early onset case, the tip off from something like Lee syndrome may be a little bit more of the liver failure as well. Diagnostically speaking, on EEG, I saw that there was maybe a little bit of a predilection to occipital predominant epileptiform discharges. And they said that it was this thing called RADS, or rhythmic high amplitude delta with superimposed spikes. I don't know if that's particularly like pathognomonic by any means, but it was something that came up on a few sources I saw. It may be something along the lines of extreme delta brush and NMDA, so associated, but maybe not 100% key. In terms of MRI findings, there are some flare hyperintensities. Usually it's going to be gray matter more so than white matter, particularly with a lot of thalamic involvement in Alport syndrome. They'll have the elevated lactate, and given the liver abnormalities, very elevated LFTs and ammonia. I think one important thing to keep in mind, particularly with treatment in these patients, given that they come in with pretty intractable seizures, is you really want to avoid valproic acid, as it can lead to an even more fulminating hepatic failure. So that's one, I would say, thing to remember, particularly about Polg G mutations and Alport syndrome specifically, is that valproic acid is generally kind of off the table in these patients. And if there's a consideration or a concern for that mutation, generally speaking, you will avoid valproic acid as well. The other more kind of broad anti-epileptics like keprotopyramide, lamotrigine are in play at least. Any other additional commentary for Alport syndrome, Dr. Moeller?
No, I'm getting sidetracked into Google images of RADS. And this is a finding I have to confess I don't think I knew about, although I don't know that I've seen a patient with Alport's syndrome. And I just a couple of Google searches while we were talking. One, Alport syndrome, I guess, is a subtype or one version of any of the mitochondrial DNA depletion syndromes, sometimes called MDDS or MDS. And as you said, that sort of triad of neurological dysfunction, liver dysfunction, and in some cases, muscle weakness, right? All things that could fit with mitochondrial disease is a clue. That early onset, again, that more severe type of syndrome. And I'm looking at these RADS, and I don't have much to say about the physiology or way to remember it, other than to say they're really striking and characteristic when I look at the images of these. They're focal delta activity, often posterior maximal, and they do have this superimposed high frequency activity on top of it. I mean, like you said, that extreme delta brush is a good analog, except that these tend to be posterior. They often start focal. So some examples I'm seeing are unilateral and then progress to bilateral. And one of the things that's been written about this EEG finding is it can be a clue to look for one of these mitochondrial DNA depletion syndromes, which can be due to the mutation, the POLG1 mutation or other mutations. But this specific mutation tends to cause a prominent encephalopathy. So I think that's a great, cool finding. I don't know if that'll show up on an exam, maybe a child neurology exam, but learn something new every day. And so RADS is spelled R-H-A-D-S. So these rhythmic high amplitude delta activity with superimposed polyspikes.
Thank you for that addition. It definitely was something new to me. That's the good thing about particularly going through these diseases outside of MELAS. I think the amount of information I had on each of these other processes was pretty minimal. So there was a lot of room for growth. Hopefully people will find this one to be helpful.
Aaron, I think this was outstanding. I'm sure you learned a lot. Our listeners will benefit from this. I think we put together some patterns that are really helpful and will help them in their careers and in being successful on high stakes examinations. So thanks for putting all this together. And as we said, we'll put your references into the notes for this show.
Sounds great. And thank you, as always, for helping fill in any of the gaps.
Oh, my gaps are much larger for this topic than most. But again, we muddled through and hopefully we were useful to people.
Thank you again, Dr. Moeller.